Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God. This is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Now until May 12th, get up to 30% off personalized jewelry, style, decor, and so many other items mom will love. And if you want her to know you put a ton of thought into her present, use Gift Mode. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can easily find well-crafted, original, and affordable pieces from small shops. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about mom, and Gift Mode instantly gives you curated ideas based on hundreds of personas. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Achtung, Achtung, it's James Holland here. Welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. This is part two of my conversation with the amazing, incredible Robin Rowlands. And for those of you who listened to the first one, you'll remember that he was just been talking about his respect for the Japanese dead and their astonishing loyalty to their emperor. Anyway, here's part two.
That was end of the end, really for us, the end of the Kohima. And the whole division was billeted, the whole of 7 Div came back to Kohima. The monsoon ended in August. I went on a we were recuperating, put it that way. And when you recuperate, you do all sorts of things. I was sent on a course, called a junior tactical course to Dehradun. And that was a good course, there's no doubt about that, it was. In July.
Was that for a different type of fighting that was anticipated in that was to come in Burma?
Yes. Yes, it was. Because unknown to us, the war went on and Arakan was still, they were still marching forward in Arakan, and no doubt the conditions there were much the same as they always were. At the end of the Kohima, and the Japs had gone, we knew that the next job would be in the scrub country, no jungle at all. More mobile, more very much more open, and enough to build an airstrip for a small aircraft.
But were you conscious that you'd just been part of a great victory?
Yes, I think we were at that stage, but just how big, I don't think the extent of it really, because we, I mean, I can see the plan of the Japs, but I couldn't see it then. Their object, there were two ways into India to beat the British, and one was through Imphal. And you will take Imphal because the road from Imphal to Kohima is metalled, and it will take tanks, it will take armoured cars, it will take everything. Once you get there, all you've got to do is to meet up with Sato's forces, who will have taken Kohima, and the road to India is then open. Well, they failed at Imphal, and that's why when you first came in today, you told me that someone had designated Imphal, Kohima, as the greatest battle of the war. I suppose it will always be a matter of discussion as to whether there was a degree of between Kohima and Imphal. I think Kohima was crucial, there's no question about it. If they had gone, then I think India would have gone. But it did depend, from the Jap point of view, in getting Imphal. But they held them back at Imphal, and I've met some of my friends back in Northern Ireland had been in the Imphal thing, and they told me about it, how they did it. But I didn't know the full extent of the battle down there, but it was pretty severe, wasn't it? Would you have any judgment on that yourself, about from what you know of reports?
I think Slim anticipated what the Japanese were trying to do. He underestimated the thrust up to Kohima, which was supposed to sweep Kohima aside and then go on to Dimapur.
Absolutely.
The danger really was, if they got to Dimapur, then there'd have been a problem, because they then would have been able to attack all those supply bases.
And the metal road would have been open for vehicles, tanks, yeah, a lot.
But it was superbly fought by Slim, and he did reinforce Kohima just in the nick of time.
He did.
You know, and he acted quickly, and the interplay between ground forces and the air transports and what was going on in the sky,
yeah,
was really tight. I mean, Slim really got that operational level really cleverly. And what he was trying to do with Imphal was do a fighting retreat from up the Tidim Road, from the Shenam Saddle and all the rest of it, towards Imphal, where obviously his supply lines were getting shorter and the Japanese were getting longer. So the idea was to, although to pull back, was to degrade the Japanese as they pulled back, mm-hmm, then reinforce and then counterattack, which is broadly what happened. Just that there was this moment of extreme jeopardy, of course.
Yes, at Kohima.
It was just a brilliantly fought battle that was making the most of understanding your enemy and how they were likely to behave.
Yeah, they did it in the end. Because I think I'm right in saying that Slim had, or somebody had at one thought of defending Dimapur. I may be wrong in that, but I have a feeling it may have been from his autobiography I got that, I'm not sure. But anyway, there was some talk, but then they very quickly realised, as you say, that Kohima was going to be the thing. And that's when they brought 7 Div up from. That's a very good example of what it was like being a relatively junior officer in the Indian Army, in action against the enemy, not knowing what was going on elsewhere, or even what the plan was. If the colonel said, we've got to attack that hill tomorrow morning, I want A and B companies to prepare a plan and attack it, that's all you knew, and you did it. But you had no idea who was on your left or anything about it. And that's all you can see. And that's why there's hardly a jot in the battalion history of what happened in Arakan. Because the hills, Italy, Abel, Cane, Boomerang, were all separate hills. And no one able to write out in battalion. The chief clerk couldn't write out, today A company did so. Nothing at all. But you were there and you knew what was happening at your on your particular day. I won't even say front, because it wasn't even the front as you and I know it. It was just a small battle, and the Japs had to be got off it.
So you went on your course and you're learning a different type of warfare.
Yes, we did. We did. Then we went. I went on the tactical. Then I went back to Kohima, and the 7 Div by now. At Kohima, the plans had been formulated from a grand scale of what we were going to do. We were going to go down through Imphal, down to Tidim, and into Burma, and we were going to reach the Irrawaddy, and we were on the attack now, not defending. It was the Japs who were now defending, and we were going to go down and cross the Irrawaddy and defeat them that way. And in order to defeat them, it would mean you'd really have to kill them in battle. They weren't going to surrender, the Japs never did. And so it went on. And that tactical course was quite good. But I remember they had there were three brigades in Sevendib, and they had military exercises before we went down. Faith, Hope and Charity were the names of the three exercises. They lasted about 3 days each. And again, one didn't really know the extent of what was going on. You knew that you were given a task to do in this exercise. You would move from A to B. But it was all very useful, and they were very successful. And if you were going on patrol, you blackened your face and you carried your rifle or whatever weapon you had and all the rest of it. And so we got. So we went down. We went down at the beginning of December. So that means we were in Kohima, September, October, November, 4 months. Refitting, getting reinforcements back from India, getting new officers in to replace the old ones. The new colonel was making his way into his new command. Main Prize King, they called him. The troops had a name for our new colonel. It was Darty Farty, because he was a very spruce individual. Very deceptive. He was a very good officer, but he was always very well turned out. And that's what he...
Great name.
And anyway, they came down, and we moved down. So if we leave Kohima behind, and really that's all there is, I've described it, the conditions. I don't think it's possible to say how frightful Kohima was as a result of that battle. It really was dreadful. And the dead bodies that had been buried all over the place, civilians. And the Nagas were extremely helpful to us from intelligence point of view, very helpful. It was the first Queens who took Jail Hill. It was the 4th 15th Punjab who did the frontal attack on Church Knoll, both of which failed because it was a frontal attack, and it was the 4th 1st Gurkhas who captured it with Horsford. So then we go down, and we're now a reconnaissance battalion, and we are trained that. And we go down to a place called Kalamio, which is down through the Kabul Valley, in a very, very malaria-ridden spot.
Is this beyond Tidim?
Yes, it is beyond Tidim. It's quite a way down, actually.
And have you crossed the Chinwin at this point?
No, we never did cross the Chinwin, no. We struck out towards the Irrawaddy, Pakoku. Yes. That's right. The map wouldn't tell you why. It was just the way we took. Our job, the Sevendib were to advance to the Chinwin by the 7th of January or some date like that. And our job as a battalion was to cover the left-hand flank. As you quite rightly point out, we were in scrub country, absolutely. One rather interesting little episode does reflect on me a bit, but quite favourably was, part of our training as reconnaissance battalion was to build airstrips. We were told how to build an airstrip because the light plane was going to be the only communication with DIV headquarters and brigade headquarters. So I was taught, and we got, when we moved forward on the left flank, marching, the first scrub country we came to was a place called Kuzai, K-U-Z-E-I-K. And unfortunately, there'd been a supply drop in the wrong place. I don't know how they managed that. We'll never know, but they did. They dropped a supply of everything at Kuzaik when battalion had moved on 2 days, covering the left flank. I was ordered to stay behind as OC rear details at this place. And the first thing I did was I got a hold of the villagers. I made them build an airstrip for me, which all it entailed was cutting a hedge down and levelling out a few ground, ending up with about 250 yards of flat country. On the very first morning after the mistaken airdrop, an L-5, a light airplane, came in thick fog and landed on my airstrip. I had to light bonfires on the edge of it to let him see where to land, part of our training, what I'd been told to do. Out stepped this rather spruce young man called Edwards. I'll never forget his name. And he came up to me and said, "Hi," and he said, "You want a flip?" And I thought, yeah, that'd be a good idea. Now, I had no idea where my battalion headquarters was. I had no idea where any of my companies were. And I was left with a 3 days' supply of ammunition, food and everything. And I was about to do that when I discovered that there were six elephants marched into my camp at Kuzaik, six elephants with one Burmese. In India they call them Mahout, in Burma they call them an Uzi, six elephants. So here was my answer, but I didn't know where the battalion were. So I said to Edwards, "Can you you've got a radio? Yeah. What frequency do you broadcast on?" And he gave me the frequency. And I said, "Well, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll go and find out one of my companies and try and find battalion headquarters. And have you got a message thing?" "Yes. It's a satchel with a leaded weight on it." And I wrote out two tags. The first one I saw was spotted Rupert, who commanded C Company. We came across him. We took off and flew at about, 1,000 feet, maybe something like that. Saw Rupert, and I dropped the first message over the side of the aircraft. Saw him pick it up. "Where is battalion headquarters?" And he went like that, up a nullabed, up a riverbed, dried up riverbed, like that. So we went round, he pointed the plane, and Edwards saw it. In a few minutes, we came across battalion headquarters, circled round. I dropped a mailbag over the side from division. And on tied to it, I said, "On receipt of this, immediately open a 22 set on a frequency of 74 megacycles." And we watched, saw John pick up the thing, read it. He was the signals officer. And in no time at all, we were in radio contact with my battalion headquarters. And I said, "I'm stuck at Kuzait. I've got six elephants by sheer chance. I will leave tomorrow morning, but it will take me 3 days to reach you." I saw him pick up this message, and that was it, and then we flew off. And on the way back to my place at Kuzaik in the air at 3,000 feet, Edwards switched on the radio for the ink spots, and I was listening to the ink spots at 3,000 feet over the Burmese jungle. The colonel must have been absolutely having kittens. He was commanding a battalion. He had missed an airdrop. It was miles away back behind him. He had no radio. I had no radio. How am I going to get this bloody stuff up? How am I going to get it up? And then this solitary aircraft appears out of the blue, saved by the bell. And he was good enough to give me a good mention at the following orders group the next day. He said something like, "That's what showing initiative means," something like that.
Well, you were saying about luck.
Well, it's luck. Another very good example of pure luck. I couldn't find six elephants anywhere. I didn't even know they were there. They'd been working for the Japs 3 days previously, probably. So anyway, that was very successful. We eventually mounted up. And then we went to Bukoku.
And this is when you were all with four corps and you were all...
This was four corps, this was part of deception. And we went down and got to the... Just before, Bukoku is on the Irrawaddy, if you look at the map. And we were given the task of capturing it. And we had to get it by a certain day. We were moving pretty fast over the scrub country.
But did you know the whole point was that this was a deception plan?
No, I didn't know that. No, the first time I... The first time was very interesting. I'll tell you in a minute about that, about when I first knew that. We went on and we got, just before Pukoku, we hit a Japanese hold-up group at a place called Majigubin. And at that, and I was, Keith McCutcheon commanding B Company, was held up by quite heavy fire from around the village area. And it took 3 days to clear that, but in the meantime, the colonel told me to take the mortars up and give them help. I took my mortar platoon up and parked it in a very tiny reverse slope, the only one I could find, which proved very fortunate. Because I had no information of what was happening at the Keith's front, but someone said that the Japs were using the pagoda as an OP. So I concentrated on the pagoda, and to cut a story short, I got a direct hit on that and fired a whole lot of mortar bombs at 2,800 yards or something. And smoke arose from that, and away it went. And the next day, Keith attacked and the Japs retreated beyond the Irrawaddy. They went about 5 miles, it was, from Majigubin to Pukoku is 5 miles. The Japs pulled out. In the meantime, they had opened up a 75mm gun on my mortars. And I was, fortunately, put them on a reverse slope. So you can imagine the reverse slope there, the shells were going over and exploding beyond the mortars. Sheer luck. I wasn't the most brilliant tactician the world has ever seen.
But also well placed.
They're well placed. Well placed. And of course, I was out in front of them trying to direct the fire of the mortars. I think the 70 millimeter Japanese gun could outstrip my mortars by a bit. I think they had a range greater than mine. So I don't think I hit anything worth talking about. But I did set this damn village on fire. 54 years later, I went back, and I told you the story of how I went back on a holiday cruise up the Irrawaddy. Went back, got out at Pukoku, and went back to see the damage that I had done 54 years before. But when we got to Pukoku, the first time I knew that there was a deception plan, when the colonel called me from my bed at 11 p.m, he said, "You are to take the mortar platoon and fire off every bomb you've got." I said, "What's the target?" He said, "There isn't a target. Fire them off at random into the middle of the river. There's an island in the river, a big island." So I thought this was great. I got the platoon out, and we fired off every bomb we had. And I said, "What's the point?" And somebody said, the adjutant or someone, that it was deception. We wanted the Japs to think that the crossing was going to take place at a place other than where they actually were. And where the division actually crossed at Mieche was about 15 miles downriver from where I was. But that night we fired off, I don't know, about maybe 200 bombs. And that suddenly the night was filled with exploding mortar bombs. And that was my part in a slim, brilliant defence deception plan. So then we were there. I then was detached from my battalion. They had stayed in Pukoku, where they'd captured it. But I was given a task. I got command of A Company by now. I was promoted. And I was given command of A Company, and I was detached duty and was told to go across the river and go down, cross onto the other side. By now it was the beginning of February, and the Japanese had decided, the big decision, that they were going to defend Burma from the East Bank, not the West Bank, which meant they'd cross the river. But the thing they didn't know, as you have know very well from your knowledge, where are the British going to cross the river? Are they going to cross up at Mandalay, or are they going to cross somewhere else? They didn't know.
Well, we're going to take a short break now, but see you all in a minute.
They used to say, go west. What they meant was go forward. Find your own way. Make something out of nothing. It can be tempting to take it easy, but discovery doesn't wait. So this summer, see what it means to make the most of dawn, dusk, and every minute in between. The truth lies west. Discover yours at TravelWyoming.com.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, welcome back to this final part of our two-day special with Robin Rowland. Here he is.
I was given command of A Company, and I was told to detach from a battalion and go on a reconnaissance expedition for the brigade right away down in the front line between a place called Chok Padaung and the other. And I had my company, and it really was pretty scrubbed out. If you could see the map, you'd see a road running south from near Pagan, Mieche is where they crossed, where the division crossed, going south there. And that was, I think, I'm pretty sure it was metalled at the time. And I was about 25 miles down there, and the object of my orders I was given by a brigade was to find out to what extent the Japanese were using a road running across the front 30 miles from the river, which meant that it was all reconnaissance.
And so I presumably if they were using it, then you would...
I'd have to report back to them, yes, and say what strength they were in and all the rest. It was really a reconnaissance patrol, which after all was part of our job as a reconnaissance battalion. I got down there and I was taking over from another officer of the 4th, 5th Gurkhas, who said he'd been occupying the hill, always sees the high ground, he said. Well, of course, I followed his example. I said, right, we'll dig in up there. And it was, if you had a one-inch map or less of the place, it was 0.1186. I can remember it. And we were shelled for 3 nights up there. I was there with the radio, and they had a... I was given a thing called Slidex, which is a cipher, a code thing. I don't think our people would have much trouble in breaking that code, but anyway, it was a code. And I had a slit trench, and I slept in a slit trench there. And for 3 nights, we were attacked. And I was the only English-speaking officer in the company then, fluently anyway. And Brigade decided to pass me a message in code when I was in a sleep trench in the middle of an attack. And we were absolutely invulnerable. I mean, we had the high ground and we had Bren guns and we had everything. There's no one could have taken that hill from us. We were well dug in. But they did attack. And I was lying in a slit trench, and I covered it with a blanket. And I couldn't, it was, the person who was passing the message was just an ordinary radio operator, wireless operator, maybe a private soldier probably. And I couldn't say, look, I'm in the middle of an attack. Would you pass this message later? I can't do anything now. Well, there's nothing I could do. The attack was going on, and there's nothing I could do. I couldn't get up and run around. And I just sat there in the trench with these bloody guns going on. Eventually I got it. And I can always remember the way the message ended. The part of it was in code, but the end of it was in clear. And it said, and report to this headquarters the steps you take to achieve this end. That was okay.
So you saw off the attack?
Oh, yes, we did. No trouble at all, yes. It was a mixed attack of... Japanese and, what do they all call those other GIFs,
yeah.
The Japanese Interior Force. And we got a number of dead bodies on the perimeter in the morning and told them to bury them somewhere. And that 3 nights running that took place. And the gun, I don't know where the gun was, it was miles, quite a long way away. But we weren't hit, that was the beauty. We were not hit once. It wasn't on a reverse, we weren't on the reverse slope this time, but they didn't hit us. So I have no idea where they were. It also entailed, next day, I had word with my company platoon commander, and I told him what our task was, to go patrol down to the road. I'd go myself, except that I had to wait in case some wireless messages came in. And I was the only English-speaking one there. So anyway, he selected one of his corporals and dressed him up in Burmese clothing, took his uniform off, put a lungi chong on, and he went down a good 20 miles south to this road, and as a Burmese civilian. It was very good of him, I must say. And he watched the vehicle, how much traffic there was going between Chowkpadong and this other place. It was all very useful. And eventually I found myself also, once on that, our telephone lines began to be cut by the Japs at night. They would cut them at night because we were so far forward. And on one occasion, I found myself being OP, observation post for the 25-pounders who were back a couple of miles back. And I was directing their fire because I was the only officer available at that point. And I had a their telephone line. I had somehow or other hooked up to their telephone line, and I was directing fire onto the Javanese positions, which were way in front of me. And that was all right. We got it. It shows you the variation you have to be ready for at any moment in a situation like that. Improvise all the time. And the general, Evans, eventually sent for me. He was moving forward. He said, you have to report to the general. He wants to speak to you about water. So he said, I went into his caravan. He said, look here, you've been operating in this area for quite some time now. What about water tanks for my troops who are coming up and for the tanks and all this? So I told him where the various... I was able to tell him where the various water tanks were, the natural ones that the villagers used. So that's another example. How he'd got to here... Well, I suppose he'd asked someone, has anybody been operating in this area that knows it? And word got around that I'd been operating, and that's why he sent for me. So that was it. So that was really that. And then it was after that our task was really a bit uneventful. We covered the left flank right down through the oil fields, Yeningyang, and we were in, saw the division pressed on. We had no more direct action in the nature of things. We were a reconnaissance battalion, and as far as the rest of the division were concerned, I don't think they had very many other frontal attacks against defended features. It was more open warfare, and we got to Pegu eventually when the atomic bombs were dropped, brought the water down. They were with us in my battalion. We had two American chaps from what they called a light aid detachment, LAD, which was medical, but they were American. And one of them came into breakfast at Pegu one morning and said, I heard on the news this morning, they're talking about some bomb. And so we looked at him and said, what do you mean? Well, he says, there's a lot of talk about some bomb has been dropped in Japan. And that's all we know about it. And we followed it up, and sure enough, it was the first atomic bomb that fell on Hiroshima. And he had been listening into his own network, the American network, and we were the first to hear of the firing. And of course, to our utter astonishment and joy, the second one fell on Nagasaki, and that brought it to an end, the Japs.
So can you remember where you were when you heard the news?
That was at Pegu, some mile. Rangoon, I think, was either about to fall or had fallen by then. I think it had.
And wild celebrations?
Wild celebration, yeah. It was a great thing because we were later... we were due to go in... The first country we were going to invade after Burma was Malaya, and we were going to go in at Port Swettenham. I can't remember the name of the operation. I can't remember what it was, but that would have been a costly one with the Japanese. It would have been.
You obviously fought a lot of your men.
Thought a lot of them. They were very, very good indeed, very good. It's one thing I learned very soon, perhaps understood is a better word, especially in Arakan and afterwards at Kohima and Burma. As a company commander or a platoon commander, whichever it is, don't ever ask your men to do something you wouldn't do yourself. That was absolutely crucial because they looked up to you as a leader and as someone that they could trust. That was it. We got one chance to have a go at the Japs at a little village. My word came through that there were Japanese in a village called Tibu and Dahatsi. Two villages. I looked at my map, oh, well. And this was from Brigade. There are Japanese reported in these. So I said, right, we'll have a go at them. So instead of sticking on top of the hill, I got my three platoons together. I got the Subedar, my second in command, said, we're going to have a go at the Japs at these two villages. And we got there. And they performed brilliantly. We had a 2 plumes up and 1 in reserve, and I was with them, and we marched there. And they were so keen to get to grips with the Japs, they just rushed to an empty village. The Japs had gone. and they were ready for them. My goodness, they would have. They were so keen.
So you've got this samurai sword. What's the story behind that?
After the war, we were sent, first of all, we went to Malaya, and that's where we were. And the weeks rolled on, and one of the jobs I got was to go up to a place called Ubon. Oh, yes, we went to Bangkok. That was it. We ended up in Bangkok as occupation troops. And one day I got an order from Colonel, you are to go up to a place called Ubon, which is a way up near where the railway, the infamous railway was, up there on the borders between there and Vietnam. You are to collect the arms of the 22nd Japanese Division, collect all their arms, and bring them down to Bangkok. So I got my company, we went up by train, we went to the river, and I collected the arms. And in the middle, and what part of the arms, I was given this samurai sword, and it's still a very sharp. And that was one of the arms that came out of the Ubon, the 22nd Division. So you have all their other military equipment.
And then you got home in 46.
So that was that. And then, we were in Malaya. Yes, we left Bangkok, and the final posting was to Malaya. First of all, away up north, still in occupation troops. And the situation in Malaya was then, the war had ended, but the Chinese communists were a thorn in the flesh. And they became, for the next 3 years, long after I left, the communists were a military target. And I think it was Dempsey or somebody was sent out to cure them. But we were there. And it was quite an extraordinary thing. We were quartered in tents just outside Kuala Lumpur. And my had a big, what they call an EPIP tent, which was a big sort of tent that you might use for a wedding reception, something almost as big as that, not quite. I was on the periphery of our lines, and some of the locals, or whoever it was, I don't know, they came out one night while I was still sleeping inside and removed the walls of the tent without my knowing. And I woke up in the morning on my camp bed, exposed to all the world. There's a Saab lying. I came home in September 46, and in October, beginning of October, I'd gone back to my law lectures at Queen's. What a contrast.
What a contrast.
Someone's often asked me, well, not often, but occasionally someone's asked me, how can you possibly fight the Japs or the communists in September and listen to a law lecture in the next month? Well, do you know what the answer to that is? A, I suppose I don't know, but secondly, my life was beginning again. I had to have a career. And you leave the army is history, the war is history to a point, and now you've got to look ahead and get your qualification if you're going to make a career of the law. And that's exactly why I did it. And I went back to Queens, and there were one or two other people who'd been in Europe, in the army. Not many, mind you, because there was no conscription in Northern Ireland, and we were all volunteers. When I went back, the university couldn't do enough for me. If you had served in the war at Queen's, they even gave me a grant for my tuition and all the rest of it. Gave me a grant, and I was given credit for the 1 year that I'd already done before I went away, 5 years before. And I did 2 years at Queen's, passed my degree and qualified as a barrister. And the rest, they say, is what happened.
Well, quite right too.
But I was very, the great thing that if anybody asked me what the best years of my life were, well, those 5 years were the best, the most formative of my life, definitely, no doubt. Northern Ireland at the age of 19, 20, very green, very inexperienced, didn't get out about the world very much to see what was going on. But once I reported at the Guards Depot at Caterham, that was the day it started. Met other people, commandos, colonels, people who'd been in the war, and you try to keep up with them, really, yeah.
Amazing what you did.
Absolutely. The very amusing part of it was when we got aboard the ship, the Strathnaver, at Greenock to join the convoy, we were cadets, one half grade above a private soldier, with little white strips. We were given the old tourist lounge. And above me was this chap who'd been in the army 12 months, same as I am. And that was my first experience of what I shall term, well, naughty songs, or well, you could think of a better word, I'm sure you could. But he introduced me to, I mean, I won't repeat the whole, I took my girl for a ramble, down a shady lane. She caught her foot on a bramble, and arse over bollocks she came. And I needn't say the rest of it. That was the first one I heard. And of course, that's what I mean, getting out into the world.
You know, meet people from all sorts.
Meet people from all sorts of life. And it just went from all then. We had many of those in our own mess night. They were purely morale-boosting songs. I mean, some of them were quite filthy, but they weren't, in a word, like that. They, for us, they were just natural morale-boosting songs.
It obviously worked.
The outside world would regard them as really forbidden. And I suppose you wouldn't sing them at a dinner party or anything like that, but they helped us enormously. But that was it. I came back, 5 years later I came back having commanded a company against the Japanese, so that I thought that was credentials enough.
Well, that's it. Thank you all very much for listening. Cheerio, and do tune in for the rest of our VJ Day 75th anniversary commemoration specials. Cheerio.